Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
First, there was fantasy baseball and fantasy football. Now, get ready for fantasy classical. I'm John Schaefer, and coming up on Soundcheck, the Spring for Music Festival is challenging music fans to compile a dream team of works they'd like to hear in concert. And later, we'll ask you, if you're not the kind of person who goes to see classical music, what would it take to get you out to the concert hall? We'll open the phones. Later. If you live in a certain New York borough, there's a new work with some local appeal. It's called 1001 Voices, A Symphony for Queens. We'll talk with composer Frank London and writer and actor Judith Sloan about a collaboration that celebrates one of the most diverse places on Earth. All of that on Soundcheck after the news. Hey there, Soundcheck listener. No news in a podcast, but I do want to say thanks for downloading the Soundcheck podcast and ask for some feedback. The crew here at the show wants to know how we can improve the podcast experience for you. Tell us what you like or don't like, about how you find the podcast, how you share it with others, what's in the show, etc. Shoot us an email at soundcheck@wnyc.org. That's soundcheck@wnyc.org. Okay, back to the show. You know that old joke, how do you get to Carnegie Hall? Well, for many people, the answer isn't practice, 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 but why would I want to? This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and next month, a series of orchestras are hoping to lure you to Carnegie Hall with their most creative programs. And that series also includes a kind of fantasy baseball contest for classical music fans, where you get to say what kinds of pieces would get you out to the concert hall. We'll open the phones and hear some of your ideas. And if you're thinking, you know, a symphony about the borough of Queens would be just the thing, well, you're in luck, because Queens is about to get a new multicultural multimedia symphony called 1001 Voices, and we'll hear all about that as well. Let's start, though, by looking at how classical concerts are usually put together. You start with an overture, followed by a concerto with a big-name soloist, and then after intermission, a big symphony, maybe by Brahms or this guy, Beethoven. Nothing wrong with that, but the Spring for Music series is after something a little more inventive, like offering you a chance to make up a fantasy program. Spring for Music's artistic director is Tom Morris. He joins us on the line now to explain. Hi, Tom.
John, how are you?
I'm well. Spring for Music, you've got orchestras from Edmonton to Alabama coming into town next month. What do you look for in their programming?
Well, each year we send out a request for program suggestions from these orchestras. And we are really looking for simple creativity in thinking about programming, not doing the usual tried and true. As you mentioned, So many programs, overture, concerto, big symphony, and there are actually many other ways to do it. And then we select what we think are the top six, and we present them at Carnegie Hall as part of the Spring for Music Festival.
Now, this year, the second year of Spring for Music, runs from May 7th through 12th. And in fact, our sister station, WQXR, is the media partner for the festival, which means they'll be airing live broadcasts each night from Carnegie Hall on 105.9 FM and online at WQXR.org. So there's that end of things, but then there's also the kind of fantasy baseball aspect of it, the fantasy program contest. You did this last year as well. Sort of tell people what it is.
Well, the idea is how many times have people who put on concerts heard from members of the public, well, I didn't like that program, I could do it a lot better. Well, this is a chance for everybody to try their hand at putting together programs. We did this last year for the first time, and it was a huge success, lots and lots of interest. And we asked people to submit a program with a rationale, short rationale for the program. Mm-hmm. They're posted on our website, and then the public is invited to vote.
Now, last year, the first contest, there were 23 submissions and thousands of people voted. Who won?
Well, there was a very wonderful young musician from New York, Peter Sachon, who won, and he came up with a very interesting program, a program that was not without controversy, but, you know, interesting program should have some controversy.
Yeah, I would think so.
But the program was Richard Strauss's also Sprach Zarathustra on the first half, and then the second half, a suite from John Williams' movie score, Superman.
All right, now which was the controversial part there?
Well, the controversial part was some people thought we shouldn't actually mix movie music or pops music with serious music. Actually, we think that there should be fewer rules in terms of what's allowed in programming. And what is fascinating to us about this program is it dared, in fact, to cross those boundaries. Mm-hmm. You know, so many boundaries in classical music, so-called classical music, in fact, all music, have boundaries which are fading. And it seems absolutely acceptable to open up standard symphony programs to other kinds of music. So this not only had an interesting sort of superhero theme to it, but it actually dared to cross a line which up to this point has been a fairly rigid one in terms of how orchestras think about programming.
So Peter Sachon won last year's contest, the Fantasy Program Contest for Spring for Music, with this program that he called Eternal Stories. Only two pieces on his program, the first one being Thus Spoke Zarathustra by Strauss. Beginning of that famous tone poem by Strauss with its inspiration from Nietzsche's Man and Superman. And in this winning program by Peter Sachon, that leads to Superman by John Williams. John Williams' score, the finale and end title march from Superman, the soundtrack. And so that pairing of orchestral pieces, one from right smack in the middle of the classical tradition and the other from Hollywood, was the winning program in the Fantasy Program Contest that Spring for Music ran last year. They have started this year's contest, began yesterday and continues through May 5th, and you can find information about how to submit and vote on your fantasy program on our webpage, wnyc.org/soundcheck. And listeners, it's your turn. If you're not the kind of person who normally goes out to see classical music, what would it take musically to get you to the concert hall? What kind of programming would you think is interesting? If you're already a classical concert goer, what would you change about the experience to get some of your friends to come along? You can leave a comment on our webpage, wnyc.org/soundcheck, or call us, 212-433-WNYC. That's 433-9692, or WNYC.org. Tom Morris, Artistic Director of Spring for Music. So why is this fantasy program challenge a fantasy? Why wouldn't an orchestra want to actually take some of these ideas and put them into practice?
Well, we actually hope that orchestras will take some of these programs. I think they're fantasies in terms of people, allowing people to dream up in their wildest imagination what they'd like to hear. But, you know, I think that's how all great programming is done anyway. It takes imagination. It takes coming up with crazy ideas, putting odd things together, and trying to create a sense of adventure within the concert.
So what's, I mean, that sounds, Tom, like such a great idea. What stops orchestras from actually doing that? Why do we have the overture followed by the concerto followed by the symphony all the time?
Well, a lot of the symphony orchestra business is trapped in an economic model of ticket prices that are relatively high, and the thought is that you have to do meat and potatoes, and you have to have major concerti with major soloists in order to sell a program. I actually believe somewhat the opposite, that I have implicit faith in the audience, and they actually want a sense of adventure. And so it's a very careful balance that you need to build over the course of a season.
Mm-hmm.
But there's so much music, and there's so much fascinating music to be played.
Well, do you think your contest, this kind of crowdsourcing approach to programming, do you think this could catch on and actually provide some orchestras with a way of tapping into, you know, what's out there in terms of what people are listening to or not listening to but wanting to hear?
Absolutely. One of the purposes of this project is not just to put on a series of concerts with a lot of interesting orchestras, with a lot of interesting programs at Carnegie Hall, but frankly to make a statement and to open up the possibilities for what programming can be.
Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of programming, orchestras do this sort of thing years in advance. I mean, you already know what's coming up next year, right?
We already know what's, and we've announced what's coming up next year, and we also know what's coming up in 2014.
Now, is that part of the problem, that orchestras have to plan their music programming so far in advance and aren't nimble enough and versatile enough to kind of respond to things that are happening in the day?
I don't think it's a problem at all. I think you can be very creative several years in advance, and then you have to have ultimately the confidence that if there's a really good idea about adjusting a program that you're going to play next month, and it makes a lot of sense, why shouldn't you make it better and more interesting?
Mm-hmm.
I've always believed that, and I think you never stop obsessing with how to make programs more interesting and more attractive.
We're speaking with Tom Morris. He's the artistic director of the annual Spring for Music Festival, returning for its second season next month at Carnegie Hall between May 7th and 12th. The orchestras come from as far away as Edmonton and as close as the New Jersey Symphony, all of them chosen for their inventive and creative programming. The Houston Symphony kicks off the festival on Monday, May 7th, with a program that presents two sides of Shostakovich, the subversive, and the guy who, for whatever reason, chose to glorify the Soviet Union sometimes, as in this symphony called The Year 1905. Tom, that'll be a great way to kick off the series. Good luck with the contest, and have a great time with all of those submissions that are going to be coming in.
Thanks. Well, we hope we get lots, and we hope everyone will come to these great concerts.
You can, again, check out details on what's coming up and how to submit your fantasy program or vote on others on our webpage, wnyc.org/soundcheck. Up next, it's our Soundcheck Focus Group. We want to hear what kind of music programming would get you to Carnegie Hall. Again, you can leave a comment on our webpage, wnyc.org/soundcheck, or call us, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And then later, we'll talk with composer Frank London and writer Judith Sloan about a new symphony inspired by the Borough of Queens. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. As we just heard, the Spring for Music Festival is running a contest asking anyone to submit a crowd-pleasing orchestra program of their dreams. Well, that inspired us to host a focus group of sorts today on the show. So here is your chance to make your voice heard. If you're not the kind of person who goes to see classical music, what would it take, musically or otherwise, to get you to the concert hall? If you are a concert goer, what would you change about the experience? Our number is 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Joining me here in the studio is New York Magazine's music critic, Justin Davidson. Justin, welcome back.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
You've written recently about this whole idea of orchestra programming. Let me quote you. Open any major orchestra's season brochure, run your finger down the small print list of dates, soloists, conductors, composers, catalog numbers, and titles, and you may discover no good reason to attend one concert rather than another. Is the danger that you end up attending none at all?
It is, absolutely. You know, the classical music audience is incredibly segmented. They're the people who know exactly what they want to hear and often want to keep coming back to hear the same things. But I think the future of the classical music as an art form depends on people who really have very little invested in the tradition of the way of presenting things and who don't have the same preconceptions. The downside of that is that they look at a standard kind of brochure, which is really based on the prestige of the names associated with it, and they don't register any of that prestige. They really don't know what it is they're looking at, and they have no basis on which to make a judgment. And the problem is that most major orchestras have very long seasons packed with dozens of names, hundreds of pieces, and it's very hard to distinguish one concert from another.
So then the question, the million-dollar question is, how do you fix it? Justin may have some ideas here in the studio, and some of our listeners have some ideas for how to fix it, beginning in Brooklyn with Harry. Harry, welcome to Soundcheck.
Hi.
So what do you think they should do?
Well, I'll tell you two things that annoy me. Number one, the ticket prices. It seems to me that $25 to $30 is what most people can afford. Mm-hmm. The other day, I heard the Takash at Zankel Hall.
The Takash String Quartet. Yeah,
yeah. And they were superb. But at $62, and for two people, that's 124 plus the subway. I have to work many hours to make that.
Yeah,
of
course,
one.
That won't get you in the door of any Broadway show, you know.
I forget about that. thanks God for TDF. And number two, and that's my particular bête noire, there are always empty seats. Now, wouldn't it be better to fill them with warm bodies?
Mm-hmm.
Then let them go to waste. They could have rush tickets half an hour before concert.
That's a really... Justin, have you heard of anybody actually doing... I mean, it seems like such an obvious thing, the rush tickets.
Well, that exists in a limited way, I think. Lincoln Center recently opened their David Rubenstein... If I've got
the Atrium,
right,
yeah.
Atrium, where they do sell day-of discount tickets, sort of along the lines of the TKTS booth at Times Square. But yeah, I mean, ticket prices are a huge barrier, and that ties into programming directly because what it does is it makes one segment of the audience unwilling to take a chance. Mm. And so all it does is it reinforces the whole prestige mechanism. Lower the ticket prices somewhat, and it makes it possible for people to say, well, I really don't know what I'm going to hear, but, you know, the worst that happens is I'm out, you know, $20-$30 and a couple of hours if I hate it. But there's a good chance that, you know, I'll be surprised by something. And I think that the ticket prices are a barrier. But as you point out, we're talking about live entertainment, and there really are very few bargains in that department.
Right. And the funny thing about ticket prices is, even if every orchestra sold out every seat at every concert, they wouldn't make money with even with those ticket prices.
No, this is a nonprofit model,
right.
And that's only part of their revenue.
So let's go back to the phone, see what some of our other listeners think can be fixed about getting a new audience into the concert hall. John's with us from Yonkers. Hi, John.
Hi, how's it going? I love Soundcheck of song.
Thanks.
And one of the sort of ideas I sort of had. I grew up basically watching a lot of movies, and my first introduction to classical music was the Jurassic Park soundtrack. And I would love to see some pop culture or movie scores, such as Hans Zimmer's score for Inception. I thought it was absolutely wonderful, and I would love to see that live.
Well, you know, I think, John, you're probably not the only person who got his first exposure to the sound of an orchestra through Hollywood. I mean, you know, Jurassic Park, Hans Zimmer's scores for not only Inception, but Batman with its kind of orchestra meets electronic sound. Justin, some really fascinating stuff being done in the world of what we're calling pop culture.
Yeah, and it's funny, a few years ago, or some years ago, I had more hopes for more overlap between Hollywood and the concert world. I thought that we were going to start to see a more broad-based generation of musicians and composers who were going to navigate more freely between them. I mean, you know, that's always been a problem. There's been somewhat of a barrier, which I thought was, again, about this prestige issue. When you know, Korngold was writing in Hollywood, he really also wanted to be accepted as a serious concert composer, and mm-hmm. he wrote some, you know, quite major pieces. But he did struggle with that barrier. And I would think that by now, anybody who's a professional composer, you know, who wanted to be in the concert hall would be able to move back and forth between those worlds quite easily. It doesn't happen as much as I would have thought.
And it happens usually in one, like John Corigliano, an award-winning classical composer, can write a film score and people will say, oh, great film score. But a John Williams or a Hans Zimmer, known as a film score composer, will find it kind of difficult to break in the other direction.
Yeah, I mean, there are a few people. There's Oswaldo Golijov is doing some of that. Right. Philip Glass, of course, has always done it. Tan Dunn has done it to some extent. But it's still kind of a rarity.
Yeah. Hans Zimmer is the one that the caller mentioned. John from Yonkers mentioned this score to Inception, which he thinks would make a great piece on an orchestra program. Some of Hans Zimmer's score to the film Inception. So one of our listeners thinks that that should be on an orchestra program, that that would get him and some of his contemporaries into the concert hall. What do you think? What would it take, musically or otherwise, to get you, if you're not already a classical music goer, to go to Carnegie Hall or Lincoln Center or any other concert venue? If you're already a concert goer, what would you change about the experience? You can leave a comment on our webpage, wnyc.org/soundcheck, or call us, 212-433-WNYC. That's 433-9692. Justin Davidson, I want to get to your sort of fantasy program in a moment, but first, our caller Russell here in New York has another idea for what might get people, might get some fannies in the seats, as George Steinbrenner used to say. Hi, Russell.
Hi. Walt Disney made Fantasia because he loved music. He felt some inspiration to visualize music. And I always fantasize. I grew up in the light show era. I used to do light shows. That, you know, going to a concert, you would have some visual thing that might be quite exciting and wonderful and different every time.
Mm. It's a, you know, something I've been thinking about, Justin, as well is, I mean, are orchestra concerts kind of in a little bubble where technology is not permitted, you know, where we don't acknowledge that there are visual media out there?
You know, classical music and orchestral concerts in particular are in a bubble in which so many things are not permitted. but I do think that there are some judicious changes being made. The New World Symphony just opened a new concert hall in which the technology was geared to projecting not just images from inside the concert hall, but actually images that are part of the composition of a piece onto screens outside for people to enjoy.
This is in Miami, by the way.
Yeah, while they're in the park outside, and it's good warm weather kind of place. You have composers like Thomas Addis who are collaborating, and that was one of the pieces that opened that hall. Polaris, I think was the name, which has a film component. When we get to my fantasy program, it's also partly a film piece.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that there is some interest in that. I think that, you know, if lights and razzle-dazzle are simply a gimmicky part of trying to jazz up what is fundamentally an audio experience, that's not going to find a lot of, you know, great constituency in the classical music world. I'm not sure I would be part of it either.
Yeah.
But certainly pieces that really do tie the visual and the musical together, I think that's, you know, a very rich source of inspiration.
So laser light show to Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, maybe not so much, but...
I'm out of there.
Okay. Joel Myers in the control room with some of the comments coming in.
John, here's a recommendation from our listener CS. CS writes, bring orchestras outside of the concert hall with flash symphonies and spontaneous concerti in public spaces with two-for-one ticket coupons handed out to bystanders. And Ken makes this suggestion, have the conductor talk to the audience, encourage applause between movements, etc. Make it a more engaging experience for the audience. Right now, the only advantage to seeing a classical concert versus listening to a recording is live sound, and that's not really worth the hassle of dealing with transportation. John, again, the subway coming up today.
And the idea of transporting the orchestra out of concert halls. Now, we've seen a couple of instances, Justin, of this sort of perforce, you know, New York City Opera taking its show on the road to four different venues around town, the Brooklyn Philharmonic, you know, still occasionally working at BAM, but also at various other venues around town, the streets of, you know, different neighborhoods in Brooklyn and stuff. That seems to be kind of an interesting way of reaching out to an audience.
It is. I mean, by definition, that kind of thing, especially when you're talking about a large orchestra, is a one-off. You know, it's a really sort of special occurrence, which means that it can't kind of build up the level, the critical mass of feeling like it's an event that you can come to expect. But I do think, you know, for instance, the New York Philharmonic is going to be doing Stockhausen's Gruppen as part of a big, very interesting event at the Park Avenue Armory in June. And that's a really interesting space that has really is at the cross section of a lot of different groups of audiences. People, it's not a classical music audience that knows about that place, but it's increasingly a real kind of exhibition space, Kunsthalle, you know, place where lots of different art and multimedia events take place.
Yeah, really interesting things. And one of the sort of big bright lights newly added to the concert venue scene here in New York. It's like the size of an airplane hangar or even bigger. Now, Leonard from West Orange, New Jersey is on the line. And Leonard has a question, Justin, for you. Go ahead, Leonard.
Would an orchestra using period instruments be an attraction to concertgoers that they would like to go and hear Beethoven's Fifth Symphony played on period instruments?
Played on instruments from the time that Beethoven was writing that piece.
Well, it does happen. There are specialized orchestras, the John Elliott Gardiner's Orchestre Révolutionnaire Romantique, which is based in London, despite its French name, I think was here fairly recently doing a series of Beethoven performances. There are orchestras that are only period instruments, and of course there are all kinds of, you know, Baroque ensembles. You know, I think that that does create interest, as does sort of almost anything that is serious and unusual.
Will that play in the cheap seats?
You know,
is the question.
I think the thing is that we tend to think of the audience, and the reality is that we deal with the audience for classical music and for orchestras, just like any other audience, whether it's TV or movies, is very fragmented.
Mm-hmm.
And the issue is, how do you appeal to multiple fragments simultaneously so that people will come to a concert for one reason and stay for another? And to me, a good program is one that can kind of cut across some of those segments of the audience so that everybody's there for a slightly different reason and has the ability to be surprised.
So is that what you've gone for in your fantasy program?
I have. I mean, my fantasy, I really took fantasy seriously, so I set aside the things that automatically kick in, which are essentially logistical and financial. I mean, it would be prohibitively expensive under almost any circumstances to do this program, but it's one that I would certainly like to hear.
Mm-hmm. So these are some of the pieces that Justin Davidson of New York Magazine is suggesting for his fantasy program. We were talking about the Spring for Music contest, opening with the third movement of Thomas Addis's Violin Concerto. Well, the folks at Spring for Music are running this fantasy program contest. We're asking listeners to come up with a program they think would be a really interesting thing to see and hear in a concert hall. And Justin Davidson, you're asking for an orchestra, a period instrument ensemble, a chamber music group. That really is a kind of an exercise in fantasy. So we heard a little bit of Concentric Paths, the Thomas Addis Violin Concerto. Monteverdi's The Coronation of Poppea, a little excerpt from that. Zoltán Kodály, the Hungarian composer's duo for violin and cello. And in the background, the young Dutch composer Michel van der A and Up Close, which has a film as part of the score.
It does. It's not quite as crazy as all that, because what I did was I framed the concert with two contemporary concertos, a violin concerto and a cello concerto, and then brought the violinist and the cellist together for the Kodály in the second half.
Mm-hmm. So it's completely pragmatic.
Well, not entirely. to me, a great program is one that is tied together not by a theme, not by a label, not by some historical conceit, but by a set of linked experiences, mm-hmm. by a kind of expressivity. And all these pieces, as different as they are, share a kind of intensity of two people or groups talking to each other and interacting in this intertwined way. So the way the violin and the orchestra relate to each other in the Thomas Addis piece has a kind of Baroque quality that's uh-huh. then part of the duo in the Monteverdi aria from Poppea, brought out again in the violin and cello in the Kodály piece. And then also this kind of intense drama, which is brought out in this piece, very interesting piece by Michel van der A, who is also a director and who created the film that goes along mm-hmm. with the music. Now, I should say it's another kind of duo there, because the film is of an older woman, and it was commissioned by a young female cellist. And the two of them, the live cellist and the figure in the film, interact on the stage. And there's a great deal of rapport between those two.
Are you going to enter this in the Spring for Music contest?
I suppose I could.
You should. I would vote for it. Justin Davidson's with me, the classical music critic for New York Magazine. Chris on the line with us from Bayshore. Hi, Chris.
Hi. I'll be quick. Back in the very, very early 70s, Michael Tilson Thomas, when he was the conductor for the Buffalo Philharmonic, brought the Grateful Dead in on stage and they each did their separate pieces, and then they combined and did stuff together, and the drummer for the Philharmonic sat in with the Grateful Dead. It was fascinating.
Wow. Well, Michael Tilson Thomas has really made a history of doing that sort of innovative programming, the American Maverick series most recently here in New York. So, you know, world's coming together. A little touch of gray from the Grateful Dead right on cue in the background. Justin Davidson, great to have you back with us on Soundcheck today.
Thank you. It's been fun.
And again, Spring for Music's Fantasy Program Contest continues. Check out our webpage for details, wnyc.org/soundcheck. Up next, composer Frank London and writer Judith Sloan celebrate the diversity of the borough of Queens in their new work, 1001 Voices, A Symphony for Queens. We'll hear more about that next. And don't forget, tomorrow we're broadcasting live from the Green Space with guitarist Khaki King and the string band known as Punch Brothers, featuring mandolinist Chris Thiele. Tune in tomorrow at 2 and join our live webcast by visiting wnyc.org/soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. There was a time when the face of Queens was Archie Bunker, the comically bigoted dad from the 1970s sitcom All in the Family. Now, the face of Queens is probably an immigrant from South Asia or Central America or Eastern Europe. Queens has become one of the most diverse places on Earth, and its mix of languages and cultures is being celebrated in a new multimedia work called 1001 Voices, A Symphony for Queens. Joining us are the composer, Frank London, and the librettist and actor, Judith Sloan. Frank, Judith, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank
Hi,
you.
Hi, John.
1001 Voices, Judith, that's just barely an exaggeration, isn't
it? It isn't an exaggeration, but you're right. And I was reading Arabian Nights about 3 years ago, rereading it, and it was coming off of this project that Warren Lehrer and I had done, Crossing the Boulevard, mm-hmm. about new immigrants in Queens, and thinking about, God, if you tell a story, it keeps you living. So I came up with this line, 1001 stories to keep me alive.
And how many cultures are, in fact,
There's 167 languages spoken in Queens now. 8 years ago it was 138, but that includes dialects. But we're including only four languages, mm-hmm. multi-languages, including English. No, five, including English.
And Frank, in terms of musical languages, I mean, you've written this piece for the Queens Symphony Orchestra, but also for elements of other sound worlds as well.
Yeah, there's Deep Singh will be the tabla soloist.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition, there's a violinist in the orchestra named
Dale Stuckebrook,
who not only plays the erhu, but he makes his own erhus.
That's the Chinese fiddle.
That's the Chinese violin. Okay. So we have the tabla, the erhu, the chorus, the mm-hmm. orchestra.
Now, Frank, I mean, some of our listeners will know your work with the Klezmatics over the years. You know, you've been a part of the so-called downtown scene here in New York going back to the 80s. What's the biggest challenge for you taking on a piece this big and this kind of sprawling and diverse?
Finding the time to actually do it in between everything else I'm doing. I mean, the thing about doing something large, my friends have all been joking, it's like the last scene in Singing in the Rain. It goes, hey, and now you can write your symphony, you know. but really, the thing about doing something large is it just takes more time mm-hmm. To do it. But I'm inspired by the community. You know, I sit there, I go, you know, Zorn can write some symphonies. Anthony Coleman writes symphonies. You know, they're my neighbors. We go out drinking together. It's like, okay. Mm-hmm. We can find it. But really, it's the inspiration of the words, of the project itself, mm-hmm. of the sounds, of bringing together all the sound worlds that are both inside of me and inside of the orchestra.
Now, the orchestra is premiering this piece called 1001 Voices, A Symphony for Queens, on Sunday afternoon. It's a free event at the Colden Auditorium of Queens College, and Konstantin Kitsopoulos will join us in a moment. We'll be conducting the Queens Symphony Orchestra. So the premiere hasn't happened yet. What we're about to hear is a rehearsal.
This is a rehearsal tape.
Just piano accompanying the chorus.
Piano accompanying and, like, you know, ceiling mics.
All right. So imagine the tabla and the Chinese fiddle and the symphony orchestra and this chorus singing the words of Judith Sloan and the music of Frank London. Bit from the symphony called 1001 Voices. I almost gave you an
2000.
Extra thousand there.
That's okay.
1001 Voices, A Symphony for Queens. The composer is Frank London, the libretto by the writer Judith Sloan, who's with me. Konstantin Kitsopoulos will be conducting the world premiere. It's a free event Sunday at Queens College with the Queens Symphony Orchestra. Konstantin, it's funny, welcome.
Thank you.
During our previous segment, we had callers saying, you know, tickets should be cheaper. There should be stuff to look at. You're doing a free concert with visuals.
With visuals, yeah, exactly.
What was the original idea here?
Well, the idea came from a New York Times article that I saw back in 2009, which was an article about Judith and her work with Irsay and Crossing the Boulevard. And so I read the article, was inspired by it, and called her. And we then set about the creation of this piece. And she brought Frank into the picture. And that's how we actually got started. The idea of doing a free concert is, with the Queen's Symphony, what we wanted to do is to serve our community in a more open way. And we found it very difficult to deal with the subscription model with the orchestra. So we changed everything and are now doing all free concerts.
Well, that's great. Justin Davidson was saying before how the audience is not, in fact, a single audience, but a deeply fragmented one. Queens, with this welter of communities and languages and cultures, is, in fact, many different audiences.
It sure is. And the thing about Queens as a borough is the people that live in one neighborhood don't necessarily travel to other neighborhoods. And so what we've done with this festival that we're doing is to bring the orchestra around the borough. Mm-hmm. To serve as many people as we possibly can.
All right. Now, you mentioned Judith and Warren Lehrer having done this Crossing the Boulevard thing. Mm-hmm. You read about that, and that sort of set the gears in motion. Judith, you and Warren, Crossing the Boulevard is also about Queens.
It is, and it's
about... Do you guys live there? Or?
Yes. This okay. is my home. I've been there for 21 years, and I think this is an evolution of that, because Crossing the Boulevard was mostly about people who came after 1965, so it's new immigrants. With this piece, I was able to go back 300 years, 400 years, and look at all this range. You know, I came when the slave ships came, after I came on a coffin ship, just all these kinds of things. And Warren, as the visual artist, you know, it moves in a way that actually, I think artistically, when we were collaborating, Warren and Frank and I would meet every week, and sometimes the visual would change slightly how I was going to write a poetic phrase, or it would change the music. Can you do something here, Frank, where we just have another note, because we can spread that out visually? And so that was a really interesting process, and So and also, just including other languages in it. Something that you said, John, before about who's coming. So if I have an Arabic actress who never goes to the symphony, but she is going to be in it, and this Russian beatboxer who now, instead of beatboxing, he's actually speaking the Russian. And so that means that all these people that wouldn't even go to a symphony and sit in the audience are
actually
bringing
part
their friends. And they're bringing their friends.
Yeah. We're speaking with Judith Sloan and with composer Frank London and conductor Konstantin Katsopoulos about 1001 Voices, a symphony for Queens, with visuals by Warren Lehrer and Brandon Campbell. Now, you and Warren did this Crossing the Boulevard thing. Again, storytelling, immigrants in Queens.
Exhibition.
In this excerpt, we have a refugee from Zaire recounting his tale of smuggling himself on a cargo flight, requesting asylum at JFK, and being held in detention there for 2 years. Here, he's finally released.
The light, the sun. I fell down because I'm used to the dark. I'm used to the industrial light. Coming not to see the sunshine, I was like dizzy and I fell down. And now, even if I don't have anything, I'm enjoying the life because I know that I'm free. There's nothing better than freedom, but I'm still discovering it.
That is some lovely storytelling and music from the prior project, Crossing the Boulevard, about immigration in Queens, from Judith Sloan and Warren Lehrer. You worked with composer Scott Johnson elsewhere on that piece, now working with Frank London on the new work called 1001 Voices, a Symphony for Queens. So how is the story, Crossing the Boulevard, we hear the people's own voices telling their stories. How does the storytelling unfold in this work?
This unfolds more poetically, so I also took a lot of liberties and meshed things. We used a few outtakes and some things that we never got to perform from Crossing the Boulevard, like in the second movement. There's a line of, I'm going to enjoy the life because I have the human right now. So we ended up using some of those things. But I guess for the third movement, you know, I gave Frank the libretto for the first movement without music, but I had ideas of, oh, this could be this, and we're gonna loop this, and it was inspired by some of the stuff I had done with Scott, where I was working in Pro Tools and multi-tracking. But then by the third movement, he gave me this music. I went home, and I thought, I know what I'm gonna write to that.
So you wrote to the music.
Yeah, that was a really different process. And some of it was difficult because he wrote this crazy rhythm in the second part.
Actually, if you have a second, this was one of the most fun compositional moments. I wrote, like Judith said, I do all these different gigs. Mm-hmm, so I was thinking about my Balkan music, but taking in a new music sense, and wrote this weird thing with a bar of 12, bar of 10, bar of 12, bar of 10, couple bars of 7, couple bars of 5, it repeats.
And I was sweating.
So then we took an interview that Judith had done with a cab driver, or a couple of interviews,
like a bunch mm-hmm. of
some
different
interviews, and we said, how can we scan this to this weird rhythm? And it gets the awkward English quality. So it goes, the only real job I had in this country is driving a cab, which I found not that different from harvesting roses every day I get in my cab, meditate, so by the time I have contact with customers, the cab becomes a sacred space.
And wow.
Because he was doing the ba-ba, I was like, oh, if you take a wrong turn, because Queens is so confusing.
Oh, my God. You know, the corner of 67th Road and 67th Avenue.
Yes, and 67th Place.
It's horrible.
Soundcheck listeners, you can actually see and hear what Frank and Judith were just talking about. There is a clip from 1001 Voices, a Symphony for Queens, on our webpage, wnyc.org/soundcheck. We're talking a little bit earlier about, you know, attracting new audiences, and Judith, you know, bringing in all these different audiences to the Queen's Symphony Orchestra on Sunday. The orchestra, though, is such a Western invention. How do you get past that?
Well, I think we had talked about this early on. Konstantin and I were talking about, can we infuse this kind of defiant spoken word energy inside and you know, make it work with the rhythm, and also what other instruments can we use? Because the orchestra is Western, but the drums came from somewhere.
Right.
I mean, all the music, all these instruments traveled before it ended up in, you know, a Western. So that's part of why we decided to use tabla, and we realized we could be using djembe, right?
And also my influences, of all the influences in my music, classical music is pretty low on the list.
Mm-hmm.
I spent many more years in Queens playing with salsa and cumbia bands. So there's an entire section where we talk about the different workers and laborers, which actually, I mean, trying to decode my influence is difficult, but it's all come from Eddie Palmieri. Before the Isaac
right,
Hayes
so it is
section, you know?
Very much a sounds like very much a New York happening.
It's a New York feast.
Sunday afternoon. It's Sunday afternoon. It's free. 3 o'clock in the Colden Auditorium at Queens College. Constantine Katsopoulos will conduct the Queens Symphony Orchestra. Frank London wrote the music. Judith Sloan wrote the text. And to the three of you, good luck with the premiere on Sunday. Thanks for being with us on Soundcheck today.
Thank you so much, John.
Symphony for Queens called 1001 Voices, wrapping up Soundcheck for today. Tomorrow, we're live in the green space. Join us for our live webcast at 2 o'clock with the string band Punch Brothers, featuring mandolin virtuoso Chris Thiele and guitar hero Khaki King. That's tomorrow, live on Soundcheck. Our technical director is Irene Trudell. The program is produced by Katie Bishop and Greta Cohn with Margaret Bresnahan. Our senior producer is Joel Meyer. We had help today from Chris Nolan. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.